Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, and welcome back for the second hour of Catholic Answers Live. So glad to have you here with us. Issues in Bioethics this hour with Father Tad Poholcek. 888-318-7884 is our number, 888-318-7884. If you've got questions about bioethics, whether it's the beginning of life, end of life, middle of life, lots and lots of new innovations in bioethics. So we have new moral questions arising all the time, and I just don't think you could find anyone better than Father Tad Poholcek to address those questions. Father Tad is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. He holds a doctorate in neuroscience from Yale University. 888-318-7884 is the number if you would like to discuss any bioethics issue you've got with Father Tad, 888-31-TRUTH. Father Tad Poholcek, thank you for being with us today on Catholic Answers Live.
I'm so glad to be able to join you. Thanks for having me on again.
But now, I got confused about where you were. I was just actually talking with someone about you, and she said, no, he's in Philadelphia. I was saying Fall River, and she said, no, Philadelphia. But is that where the National Catholic Bioethics Center is, Philadelphia?
It is in Philadelphia, that's correct. But I am originally from Fall River, from the Diocese of Fall River. I'm incarnated as a priest there. So my bishop has kind of put me on loan, if you will, to the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia.
Well, we are all grateful to your bishop for that, because these are strange times as far as bioethics and all the new. It seems like every day almost there's something new in the field of biology that we either can celebrate or be concerned about, and in most cases, I'm going to say both. Even the things that we celebrate, depends on what you do with it. It seems almost always to be the kind of answer to, is that moral?
Yeah, that's right. That seems to be the take-home message, that you have wonderful potential for incredible breakthroughs occurring in science, and then you always scratch your head a little bit and say, well, gee, you know, I can also see how this could be misused. And so it really requires, I think, a refined moral sense. And for a lot of people who don't come at these questions with the advantage of a Catholic background, I sometimes wonder to myself, how do they sort through these kinds of questions? You know, it is such a blessing to have the church, the teaching authority, reflection of centuries on complicated questions, and to be able to sort of fall back into that and to realize that, you know, even in the face of remarkable and rapid technological developments, you still have this kind of bulwark supporting you as a believing Catholic.
And the church is at the so well prepared at these things, but it does seem that the church in the United States has a particular obligation. I'm just thinking of an interview I saw once with Pope Benedict, now Pope Emeritus Benedict, where he said that at the CDC, CDF,
Congregation
right.
for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Right. Uh-huh. He said often that when new bioethics issues would come up, they would allow the church in the United States, or they would kind of depend on the church in the United States to work through many of the issues, because that's where many of the things were happening, and that then they could take those lessons and use them for more worldwide responses.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an element of truth to that. I think the fact that the United States has such an advanced scientific enterprise, really, that's just all the time pushing the limits, that this has had that practical effect, that the questions get to be gestated here, as it were, and processed perhaps for the first time. And, maybe that's changing now as we see science really becoming more and more internationalized, but I would certainly agree that for the longest period, it seemed like that was a good description of how things would develop scientifically, and the ethical discussion would be occurring, right in parallel with that.
And, you know, you were saying it's hard to imagine how someone who's not Catholic doesn't have the benefit of it. And we're not saying we're better than other people, but we do say that there's a long tradition of meditating on and thinking about and thinking through these issues in the Catholic Church using both theology and philosophy. But I do think there, just as the just war theory came to inform a great deal of the world on war, and that was originated in the Catholic Church, don't you think there's a role for the church to set basic kind of parameters that other people can take up, whether they're Buddhist or Hindu or of no religion at all, and say, okay, here's some basic guidelines in the way that just war theory helps us to understand what's moral and not in war?
Definitely. And I think what's really going on there is that the Catholic Church is not out there when it comes to these moral issues. It's not coming up with some kind of very, very restricted viewpoint. People sometimes try to frame it as if that's what the Catholic Church does, and you have to be a Catholic in order to believe that, oh, I don't know, abortion is wrong or something. But of course, that's completely untrue. The reality is that the Church is always reminding the rest of the world what the rest of the world already knows by conscience. The conscience of man is attuned to very basic truths about good and evil, about right and wrong, but man has sort of fallen out of touch with his own self. So the Church is always hearkening and calling people back to that touchstone, as it were. And when the Pope writes encyclicals, he often starts them off to all men of goodwill. You know, yeah. It's not just written to Catholics or Christians even, but to all men of goodwill, because there is clearly such a huge element of commonality that we share and that the Church seeks to vivify and revivify, if you will, as these kinds of questions surface.
888-318-7884 is our number, 888-31-TRUTH. If you have a question for Father Tad Boholcik on any area of bioethics, we are more than happy to take that question, whether it has to do with the end-of-life issues, beginning-of-life issues, maybe some of the new kind of manufacturing of life issues. We're very happy to take those calls, 888-318-7884. And Father, I don't like to miss an opportunity to ask you about this, because I do have some concern about this, this new CRISPR technology that they have. And it's called CRISPR-9.
CRISPR-Cas9.
Okay. And that's basically, it's like a cut and paste for genetics, where you just...
That's right.
Cut and
it's
paste.
It's basically a way to cut little pieces of DNA in a very, very specific location, and then to make modifications. So if you've got a gene that's bad, that has a defect, you can go in, and if you know exactly where that defect is, you can remove that and replace it with the correct sequence. So this has, you know, tremendous implications for disease treatments that are genetically based.
But it has other possibilities as well, like the so-called enhancement of human beings. And would it be fair to say that we shouldn't speak about the enhancement of human beings, because God made us, and our lives are a gift, and the idea that, well, they're not good enough, we should make them better, isn't that problematic?
Well, it is. I think that this distinction between a therapeutic intervention, where you're fixing something that's kind of gone wrong, versus the decision, well, I want to make somebody more than what they were. I want to make a soldier who has super strong muscles and who has the ability to endure higher temperatures than the rest of us so that he could be excellent in warfare, and genetically produce an individual human being of that type. That is a whole new can of worms, a whole new ball of wax, and really raises all kinds of concerns about whether we even know what we're doing many times as we step into this arena of, as you noted, of enhancement, of making humans into superhumans according to the vision, the grand vision of mankind, of man himself creating himself, rather than deferring to the recognition that there is something primordially very, very good about the way that God has created us. And yes, original sin has come in and messed up some of these elements of our being in ways that need to be reordered and fixed and corrected. But to suggest that it's up to us to recreate the nature of man in man's own image, that really does raise serious concerns for the future. And CRISPR is a technology that if you start applying it to human embryos, you indeed will be able to make modifications of this type, modifications that involve potential enhancements and not just strictly therapies for diseases.
And that's really a grave offense against the dignity of that person who's in the very early process of development to say, oh, no, that we'll just rewrite that.
Yes, it's an offense against their dignity. And if it's the kind of change that will be passed on to their children later, then it's an offense against, you know, the dignity then of the rest of that lineage by presuming that we know what should be imposed upon future generations of men in our, hubris, really, around this kind of technology.
888-318-7884 is the number. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest this afternoon, and you're welcome to call him Father Tad. If you like issues in bioethics, we've got lots of folks on the line, so Father, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back to take those calls on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers. Our success depends on you.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm really excited to tell you about a special limited-time offer we've got right now on subscriptions of our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine. Sign up today during our annual subscription drive, and not only can you save big bucks off the normal price, you can get a collection of 5 exclusive audio presentations added to your order for free. Subscribe today at 818-487-2011 or online at Catholic.com. Sign up for a 1-year subscription, and we'll give you $10 off the normal price. Better yet, become a 2-year subscriber, and we'll up the ante by dropping the price $20 and sending you a customized Catholic Answers flash drive containing exclusive talks from a top-notch line of speakers, including Chris Check, Carla Broussard, Tim Staples, Cy Kellett, and my talk, Answering Atheism. That's a savings of $20 plus 5 brand new audio presentations when you sign up for a 2-year subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Act now. This is our best offer of the year, and it's only available for a limited time. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine before our annual subscription drive ends. Phone 818-487-2011 or go to Catholic.com today.
Talking about abortion can be scary, but so is anything with which you're unfamiliar. People need to learn how to talk about abortion in ways that inspire confidence in the truth of the pro-life position. We must talk about abortion because we are afraid. Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue, is the new book by apologist Trent Horn that teaches you to face those fears, to engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue with the goal of persuading others. Field-tested on college campuses, Persuasive Pro-Life will help you to change people's hearts and minds and begin to build up a pro-life culture in today's world, one person, one conversation at a time. Order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue, today by calling 1-888-291-8000, going to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore in your area. Also available as an ebook.
Why does God sometimes reveal himself privately? How does the Church discern reports of supernatural miracles and apparitions? What are some of the most famous Marian apparitions in history? And what do they teach us? In 20 Answers, Apparitions, and Revelations, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, explaining the scriptural and theological basis for private revelation, unpacking the Church's approach to evaluating and promoting miraculous phenomena, and sharing inspiring accounts of approved apparitions and revelations from the distant past to the present age. 20 Answers, Apparitions, and Revelations is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Father Tad Baholchik, Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center, is our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. I am your host, Cy Kellett. 888-318-7884 is the number. And if you have questions on any area or about any area of bioethics, please give us a call. 888-318-7884. We go now to William in Little Rock, Arkansas, listening on the EWTN app. William, your question for Father Tad.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Father Tad, how do you think our Blessed Mother views the upsurge in a definite upsurge in evangelicals seeking to obtain frozen in vitro embryos and implanting them lately in their own uterus so that these children can have life? I know we don't do it in the church, but it's an unusual thing. And what is the what's the status of this? How do you, as an ethicist who is an educated Catholic, address this?
Well, William, that's an excellent question, and I think it's one that more and more Catholics are pondering themselves, wondering if the fact that some of our Protestant brethren are doing this, and they've actually set up a program called the Snowflakes Program, which seeks to facilitate the adoption of these abandoned frozen embryos, basically pull them out of the deep freeze, give them to couples who would be willing to implant, gestate, and raise these embryos as their own children. So it's an area that has not been definitively resolved within the Catholic Church. It still remains open and discussed very actively and debated quite a bit. But I must say the most recent church document that came out of the Vatican that looked at this question, it was called Dignitas Personae, came out a few years back. It used what I can only call strongly cautionary language here. In other words, it said there's a host of problems and concerns that are likely to attend to this proposal, granting that the intentions of the people who do this are very, very good intentions. They're saying to themselves, oh my goodness, look at, we have now a million embryos, a million plus, just in the United States that are trapped on ice. What can we do to rescue them? And they want to free them from these frozen orphanages. Well, good intentions, as we know, are not quite the totality of the story. There's always this question of whether what you're actually doing is itself morally appropriate and ordered or not. And I personally have significant reservations about the morality of this project. A woman is becoming pregnant without having had relations with her husband to make her enter that pregnant state. A stranger's child, a stranger's embryo is being imported inside her body in order to bring about this pregnancy. And I am convinced that this involves a type of violation of the marital covenant, of the exclusive way that that husband and wife committed their bodies to each other when they chose to get married. So I'm, you know, not maybe the majority opinion on this. I think there are a lot of, you know, faithful Catholic theologians who basically would agree with the Protestants' approach here and say, yes, under certain circumstances, it should be okay to adopt embryos in this manner. But I personally am convinced that it's always something that one should not do and that it involves fundamental violations of the nature of the marital commitment and the marital covenant that exists between a husband and a wife. So that's kind of the short answer, William. I think you know, we have to wait until the church definitively reaches a judgment, but certainly the most recent documents point out that the church is moving away from any kind of potential sanctioning of this, as far as I read the tea leaves.
It sounded like you were heading in that direction yourself, William.
Yes, exactly. I think of our Blessed Mother's saving of herself, if you will, for her spouse, the Holy Spirit, and then forever being, you know, chaste and celibate, simply being the best example for us. And the ends do not justify the means in terms of violating the marital covenant between a man and a woman. And yes, my heart breaks and bleeds for these embryos, yet, that doesn't really appear to be the answer.
Well, yeah, you know,
thank
when
you
we talk
for your
about
concise
the answer,
answer.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about the answer, William, I think a lot of good intentioned people are attracted by this proposal to do embryo adoption, to throw their energy into this and say, this is a way we can sort of rescue. But it's not really an answer, because the reality is that right now, even as you and I have this conversation on air, in every major city in the United States, we basically have an assembly line production of human embryos going on. And that assembly line, you know, the cranks are turning and the embryos are just being spit out at high speed as they're being produced here and then frozen. It's almost a manufacturing protocol. And that's where the real evil resides, in the fact that, you know, we as a country have not taken even the most basic steps to limit that incredible evil of creating human beings and trapping them in liquid nitrogen. Meanwhile, if you live in Italy or in Germany, they have laws in both of those countries that say you may only make a maximum of 3 embryos, all of whom must be implanted into the mother. You're not allowed to freeze those embryos. You're not allowed to experiment on them. You're not allowed to do any of these other things that can happen to embryos, like discarding them. Instead, they have to be implanted. You know, if we could just have a law like that, it would at least stop the assembly lines. It would stop the presses, as it were. And that would already be a huge step in the right direction. So, you know, this is sort of a tiny little Band-Aid that some of the Protestants are trying to put on by adopting one or two embryos here or there, while we have thousands of them being, you know, mass-produced.
It's very stark, the way you talk about it, Father, and one wonders in America if you could get a law like that, because to admit that the embryo is a human being, that this is an embryonic human being, is maybe a step too far for many people in our country.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. That's one of the problems. And the other problem is that the in vitro fertilization industry is a multi-million dollar industry, maybe even now, you know, approaching billions. So when you have that kind of money, as soon as anybody hints at the possibility of limitations, restrictions, ethical oversight, they rise up and, you know, through lobbyists and others, will immediately countermand any effort to limit what they're doing. They really are, you know, the bull in the china shop if they want to be. And that's I think, another practical limitation to getting this kind of legislation even to be looked at. Yeah. There would be a very vocal resistance.
Somewhere I read, money is the root of all evil. I know it'll come to me where I read that. Michael in Houston, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio, your question for Father Tad Poholcek.
Hi. My question was, recently I heard in the news some story of scientists or technology where they grow human body parts in animals, like in pigs, like ears and things like that. And I was wondering, how does the church feel about that? You know, is that okay or that's not okay?
All right. Well, Michael, that's a good question. It actually is going to depend on the details of how this is done, because there are a couple of ways you can do this. Let me tell you one way where it's definitely always wrong. And this involves what we read about, this tragic story of Planned Parenthood selling fetal body parts to researchers. So that there was a huge exchange of money, and body parts were made available to researchers, and some of those researchers were able to get certain organs after an abortion that were then incorporated. They would basically put them into small animals in order to grow the human body parts that they had gotten from the human fetuses. That kind of experimentation will always be wrong. We should never be using fetal parts from human abortions, direct abortions. There's no way to get valid consent for that kind of research. And, you know, there was a huge outcry when it was discovered that Planned Parenthood was systematically doing that. So that's one direction where it's always wrong. Now, there's another approach here that might be able to be done that would be acceptable, and we'll talk about that after the break.
Oh, what do you? You don't need me at all, Father. You know how to handle this. Father Tad Poholchik, our guest this hour. We will indeed get to the second part of that answer when we come back right after this. Issues in bioethics is our topic. If you want to give us a call, 888-318-7884. We'll be right back after this.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
We've all heard the phrase, the new evangelization. In previous centuries, missionaries would travel to foreign lands to evangelize, but today's missionaries are more likely to focus on fallen away Catholic neighbors or relatives. But what about the old evangelization? The two millennia of Catholic missionary efforts by the likes of St. Paul, St. Augustine of Canterbury, St. Francis Xavier, and most importantly, our Lord Himself. We must not forget the methods they used to spread the faith to the farthest reaches of the world. Our situation may be new, but the essentials of evangelization always remain the same. In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, author Eric Sammons provides a practical guide to putting these essentials into practice in everyday use in your interactions with family, friends, coworkers, and even fellow parishioners. Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you visited Catholic.com lately? We've got a whole new look, better navigation than ever before, and lots of great new features to make your Catholic.com experience one that will have you coming back again and again. You'll find the answers to thousands of questions on all things Catholic, and our extensive library of audios, videos, tracts, articles, and more gets larger every day. When you need answers about the Catholic faith, turn to someone you can trust. Catholic.com, the most trusted destination in Catholic apologetics. That's Catholic.com.
It's the start of a new day for Morning Catholic Radio.
Monday mornings sometimes make me say, Lord, have mercy, give me the strength. And so let's remember that after every Good Friday is the Easter Sunday. And guess what? After every Monday is going to be another Sunday.
To quote St. Paul from Philippians, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice.
Iterum dico vobis.
Morning Glory, Catholic from the start. Weekday mornings, 7 Eastern on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Poholchik, the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center, is our guest this hour, and our topic is issues in bioethics. Before we went to the break, Michael in Houston, Texas, had asked about growing and harvesting body parts from animals. I think he gave the example of an ear or something. And you said, Father, that depended on how it was being done. And so maybe you could pick up from there. You gave maybe just review your first point before we move into the second.
Yes. The first point being that if we're using human organs that have been taken from children who were aborted, direct abortion, then this will obviously cross a fundamental line, and using those organs to grow them in animals for research purposes would never be acceptable, because one can't get consent from those children or from their parents who carried out the abortion. It's not valid consent if their parents say that it's okay. It's not okay for them to be doing this with their own children. The other way, though, that can be done, that you can approach this, it is possible to take, for example, a pig embryo and to put inside that embryo, when it's still very, very small, some human stem cells. And if those human stem cells are derived in a way that is morally okay, for example, there's a way that you can take your own skin cells and turn them into stem cells. If you did that and then took those stem cells and put them into the animal embryo, and then let's say it's a pig embryo, and you grow up the pig and you're hoping that maybe that pig will grow a human kidney instead of a pig kidney, which could then be used because it was your cells that started out, maybe that kidney could be transplanted into you. Now, if you did it with all those things in a row, all those ducks in a row in that way, then there wouldn't be any fundamental moral problem with it. Now, of course, if you chose to use stem cells that did come from killing an embryo, then you would again be right back where you were with the abortion, and you would have crossed a key moral line, and that kind of research would be wrong for you as a researcher to partake of. So these things are detail dependent, and this is part of the reason it's so important for scientists to become more and more conversant with these elements of bioethics and medical ethics that are critical to their work.
How does that strike you, Michael?
Oh, that's kind of what I thought, but I just wanted to hear it from the expert. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for that call, Michael. So, Father, is there, like, at some point in our future, say, I develop liver cancer or something, a potential for growing a liver in an animal and then using that as the transplant liver?
Yes, there is that potential. I would say it's still quite far down the road. We're talking probably no sooner than 15 or 20 years from now. But, you know, they have definitely started those kinds of research avenues. So it is just a matter of time, technology, and throwing enough money and graduate student man hours of slave labor, as I like to say, you know, before this probably will work.
Well, you having gotten your PhD at Yale, is that really that's how it works in academia? While you're getting your PhD, your slave labor to do that research?
Well, there's certainly a sense in which it feels like it. I can tell you, as a student, in those kinds of settings, you have to put in just unbelievable hours in order to make your experiments work. You just have to be there all the time. So, you know, I remember I lived in the lab. Sometimes I would work all night in the lab, and the next morning, as other people were coming in to start their work day, I'd still be there, and then I'd be heading out the door, you know, to go and catch a few hours of sleep and then come back. So it's a lot of work to do really intense, serious science in the lab.
We're so lucky to have a priest who has done it, though, Father, or blessed, I should say, to have a priest who has done it. Really, I think that's an extraordinary thing because you can speak both languages. Like, it is a kind of way, a kind of being bilingual. You have the language of science and you have the language of the faith.
Well, it does seem like there's a necessity in this day and age to be conversant in certainly the language of science and the language of faith as well, because I think they are often set up as opposed, as counter to each other. And that's a false dichotomy. At the end of the day, it's the Lord God who is the source of all order. And when you're a scientist, you are studying that order in the most incredible level and detail. Sometimes I think you're studying it so closely and so intensely that you almost dissociate yourself from the magnificence of it and lose touch with the fact that it's the work of the Creator, His handiwork that you're investigating. And that's always, you know, a sad thing when that happens. I sometimes use an analogy with people. I say, you know, it's a little bit like the airline pilot. When I fly on airplanes, I'm always amazed as you take off, it's cloudy and dark, and then you go up higher and you punch through the clouds and you see the sun and you see all these beautiful formations, cumulonimbus and all these other clouds up there. And I think to myself, wow, how could any pilot ever be an atheist? And yet they get used to it. And the marvel of it wears off, and they lose touch with that magnificence. So, you know, the same temptation, I think, can happen for the research scientist as well.
Have you, just out of curiosity before we go to the next call, have you heard of the new organization the physicist Stephen Barr is starting? I think it's the Society for Catholic Scientists.
Yes, I'm familiar with them. I actually concelebrated a mass, one of the first masses that they had up at MIT in Boston. It might have been, I don't know, 3-4 months ago, maybe a little bit longer than that. And so I am familiar with the group, and I work with, you know, various people who are members of that group. And I think it's a great initiative to build up some solidarity among Catholic scientists and researchers. And sometimes I think Catholics feel a little bit like they're on an island in the midst of an ocean that's raging all around them, and they don't feel that they have a lot of other people who can share their understanding. So it's great to facilitate that. That kind of group does it. Also, there's another group out there, the Catholic Medical Association. They do tremendous work in bringing physicians and other medical professionals together to be able to share the faith and the life of the faith and even spirituality. So I think that kind of outreach is incredibly valuable.
Father Tad Poholchik, our guest this hour, Issues in Bioethics. Any question you've got in the field of bioethics, 888-318-7884 is the number. Yolanda in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on KBSS. You are on with Father Tad. What's your question?
My question is that if there are any studies done to in vitro children, we have now a good bunch of years, is there a possibility to have sort of a study done on them to see if they are like any other human being? Anything like that?
Yolanda, there have been a number of studies that have been done as follow-up studies on IVF children. And probably the most striking finding is that the rate of birth defects among IVF children is about twice the rate of normally conceived children. This is something that has been studied over and over and has been verified by multiple investigations. And it's not entirely clear what the reason is, why there is an elevated risk of birth defects. But for certain types of disorders, for example, the probability that your IVF baby will be born with part of the stomach outside the gut space, it's about a 6-fold elevated risk compared to a normally conceived child. You know, and sometimes people say, well, maybe that actually makes sense, because when you think of what's going on, that we're taking sperm and egg, we're manhandling and manipulating them, maybe washing the sperm ahead of time, then we're putting them together in a petri dish, we're putting them in a completely unnatural environment of this liquid, this tissue culture medium, as it's called, that they're expected to grow in for a few days before we return them to the mother's womb. You know, we're subjecting these very young humans to quite a few different stressors, and maybe this is part of the reason that we see this significantly elevated rate of birth defects among IVF children.
Is that what you were looking for, Yolanda?
Yes, but are the birth defects of a different kind, or is the birth defects of a usual kind?
They're birth defects of multiple different kinds. There's not like one birth defect that would be characteristic for IVF children. I mean, for example, if you look at retinoblastoma, which is a type of eye cancer, IVF children also have an elevated risk of having that occur compared to a normally conceived child. And, you know, a whole range of other types of defects and problems that they will have that manifest. So there doesn't appear to be any defect that would be specific to being an IVF child. It appears to be something that is just simply a generalized occurrence because of the way that you came into the world through that IVF technology.
Thank you very much, Yolanda, for that call. And Father, if I could, just before we go to the break, when we talk about children who are conceived in this way, whether they have an elevated instance of birth defects or whatever else might be the case, these are God's children in every way. the same as a child that would be conceived in any other way. Is that correct?
That is correct. These children came into the world differently than you and me, but through absolutely no fault of their own. So they are as innocent as you and me. And if there's moral culpability, it's certainly not on their shoulders. You know, they are innocent bystanders. The culpability rests with the decision that was made by their parents. And that is, you know, where the church has always emphasized that this is not a proper way for parents to misuse even their own sex cells, and by handing those sex cells off to others who are paid to then create children on your behalf. Granted that infertility is a, you know, very, very difficult burden and cross that a couple may encounter in marriage, but when that happens, you know, this has to be seen as an invitation from the Lord to discover, how is it, if we can't have children of our own flesh and blood, how is it that God intends us to indeed have children? And he does intend for there to be a different kind of fruitfulness, maybe through adoption, maybe through becoming a school teacher where you have a whole classroom of children that you're a mother figure or a father figure to, or maybe through big brother, big sister types of outreach to children in the community who have lost their parents. These are authentic modes of parenting that are so desperately needed. We have a whole generation that has been raised almost fatherless, and we have, you know, generations that have suffered from divorce in terrible ways as well. And, you know, just manifest opportunities that the Lord opens before those who may encounter infertility in the course of their marriages. So to think, though, that, you know, this would entitle us to step outside the bounds of the marriage here and to start creating children, that's where the problem, the moral problem arises. And we begin then treating our children as if they were products to be manipulated or even frozen. And stored, trapped in those, as I called them earlier, frozen orphanages of liquid nitrogen.
More issues in bioethics with Father Tad Poholchik right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop Robert Baer, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clear witness to the gospel." St. Paul Street Evangelization's online School of Evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 5:17, Jesus said to his disciples, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill." The Ten Commandments, the expression of liturgical prayer, the liturgical calendar, blessings, incense, water, wine, priesthood, days of fast, sacrifice, all of these aspects of ancient Judaism remain in his church, but transformed and given completion by his passion and resurrection. "Blessed are you, Lord God of all creation. Through your goodness we have this bread to offer. Blessed are you, Lord God of all creation. Through your goodness we have this wine to offer." These are Jewish ways of praying. In all of Christianity, nowhere will you find more of its Jewish roots than in Catholicism. Blessed are those who recognize the old law's fulfillment here. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Final segment of Catholic Answers Live. One of our favorite guests, Father Tad Boholcik, who is the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And that's what we're talking about, bioethics. Father, earlier we had a caller who dropped. I'm not exactly sure why she dropped, but a fascinating question, and I wanted to share it with you. She was asking, is it wrong for her, she's saying, is it wrong for me to perform transvaginal ultrasounds for follicle development for women before they go to an IVF specialist? So maybe you have to tell us a little bit about what that all means and then answer that question.
Yes, this is a very interesting question. So there are some people who work in clinics and work especially with women, and you can use a special probe that will basically be an ultrasound probe, and it'll let you see whether on the woman's ovary, whether her eggs are ripening. In other words, getting ready to be released out of her ovary. And so she's asking, well, look, is it all right for me to do a test like that with the ultrasound if I know that that woman, after she leaves my place, depending on what I tell her, that yes, your eggs are maturing or no, they're not, that she's going to then go over to the IVF clinic and do IVF. Is there a problem? And indeed, there would be a problem with doing that kind of ultrasound if you knew ahead of time that this indeed was the reason that she came to you. She wanted to find out if she was going to have eggs that could then be harvested and used to join with somebody's sperm in the laboratory to create life. So one should not cooperate in that evil that the patient was contemplating to do. But let me tell you, this doesn't mean that doing these transvaginal ultrasounds in general is always wrong, because you could have a case where, for example, a husband and a wife are trying to get pregnant, and they're saying, gee, it seems like we can't get pregnant. What's going on here? And they say, well, let's go to a specialist. And the specialist says, well, let's do a transvaginal ultrasound and see whether you are maturing any of your eggs or not. And, you know, you could even use it one step further where they might say, what we'll do is we'll do this test regularly and find when your egg is just about to be mature, and then you can have marital relations and increase the chances that you will successfully conceive a baby. And that would be a wonderful use for the transvaginal ultrasound to be able to assist that that couple that's struggling with the possible issue of infertility. So like so many things in bioethics, it always depends on how you're going to use a particular technology. And there are good uses and there are bad uses, morally bad uses, that we clearly need to sometimes step away from.
And is the person who would do those ultrasounds, is that a technologist or a doctor or a nurse, or who's usually doing that?
That would usually be a technologist of some type, someone who has specialized training in running these ultrasound machines, and who also would have some experience in reading the output from the machine as well.
So would that person necessarily know the purpose for which this was being done?
Not necessarily, but I suspect that in many, if not most cases, they would. There's oftentimes a kind of paper trail that precedes these engagements, these appointments at the doctor's office.
Oh,
and
yeah.
People, you know, tend to know what things are going to be for what purposes as the day is unfolding.
We go now to Kathy in Beaver Creek, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Kathy, your question for Father Tad Boholcik.
Yes, thank you. Could you tell me if there's a gene for schizophrenia, and if there is, if the person has children, is there a high risk the children would get that or another mental illness?
Okay, Kathy, I don't recall off the top of my head whether there is a single gene. I'm reaching deep into my memory, and I seem to recall that schizophrenia is believed to be what they call multifactorial, that there isn't typically just one bad gene, but that there might be multiples, and there might also be issues of development of the brain of the way that the brain developed in utero and later that is likely to be important in schizophrenia. So I don't believe that in most cases that one would be talking about an ability to directly pass this on to children. But again, I'm reaching a little bit here without having the full data set in front of me. So the bottom line is that the schizophrenia question is going to require, I think, further research on your part and on mine to come back to it. But I'm telling you what I recall about that particular anomaly of the brain.
Okay, Kathy?
You have relatives that already have it, and then your child develops it. Say your grandmother had it, and then your child had it. Doesn't that kind of tell you it's genetic?
Well, and you're saying it skipped a generation, so the grandmother had it and the grandchild had it, right?
Right.
So there was somebody in between who didn't. No, I don't think that you can derive any conclusions just based on an occurrence like that. This, I'm quite sure schizophrenia is significantly more complicated in the way that it plays out than what you're suggesting. There may be, you see, I recall also there are families that do have a stronger propensity to manifest the disease, but I think that those are only a very, very small subset of the total number of cases of schizophrenia that are out there, and that most situations of schizophrenia, in fact, are more complicated or, as I said, multifactorial. There's a lot of things that go into actually causing that disease to manifest.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Again, we're growing short of time, so I'm going to keep moving along quickly. Emily in Greenville, South Carolina, listening on 1300 AM. Your question for Father Tad Boholcek.
Hi, Father. Thank you for taking my question. I have remembering from ninth grade biology, cutting some things in half and having them like grow back again, grow worms, becoming like a whole worm again. You get two worms now. Do you see and foresee it in the future being able to, say, through adult stem cells, have people regrow amputated limbs?
It is amazing what some of the worms and the lizards can do when you cut off their tails and so on. I would be surprised if it were possible to do that on a really large scale, like an adult human with a whole arm or a whole leg cut off. That's really asking a kind of entire developmental sequence that happened in the uterus, in the womb, to now occur on this massive scale and in a controlled way. I suspect that, I know that they're working on trying to do this, but I think they're going to be facing some difficulties also from potential uncontrollable growth. When you ask cells to suddenly replicate madly, that's also what cancers do. So, you know, it's a tricky area that I don't actually see anytime soon a likelihood that that would arise. I know it is definitely a declared goal of some researchers, but I don't think it's something that's on the horizon.
Okay. Emily, thank you so much for that call. We go now to Paul in Minnesota, listening on the EWTN app. Paul, your question for Father Tad.
Hi, Dr. Tad. I want to thank you a whole lot for the ethics that you bring to the science exploration of this type of thing with the embryos and stuff.
Paul, hang on. I got to interrupt you. You got to go quick because I went right up to the end of the show. So go ahead real quick with the question.
Okay. I kind of wonder how much for government to have any ethics as far as embryos are concerned, if abortion has any influence on them being able to say, okay, well, this embryo is a person and this one's not, so therefore they don't do much in the way of ethics on embryos at all.
Well, I mean, the question of connection between abortion and in vitro fertilization, I think, is real in the sense that when you do IVF, sometimes you implant 3, 4, or 5 embryos. And if you have, for example, a triplet pregnancy that arises, they recommend a selective reduction, which means that you target maybe 2 of those 3 growing embryos for abortion in order to get rid of them. So yes, abortion and IVF are certainly connected, I think, in many ways, even in the practical realm within our society. The fact that we allow for abortion plays out when we go down the road of doing assisted reproductive treatments like IVF, in vitro fertilization.
Paul, thank you very much for that question. Thanks for getting it out quickly. Father, I'm sorry I took you right up to the end of the show. Didn't leave you much time for that. But Father Tad Poholchik, thanks for being our guest today on Catholic Answers Live.